Today is Wednesday, August 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump reacts to Joe Biden's vice presidential pick.
One of the reasons that surprised me, she was very disrespectful to Joe Biden.
Plus, the WHO releases guidelines for dental care during the pandemic.
WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases.
And how Google wants to help save lives. We'll have these stories and more next. Joe Biden's pick of Kamala Harris as his running mate is historic in several ways. AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Mirghani starts us off.
Harris is the fourth woman to run on a major party presidential ticket, but there are several firsts.
First multiracial woman, first black woman, first South Asian woman.
Debbie Walsh, who studies women and politics at Rutgers University, says Biden's pick could become even more historic if he wins the presidency but does not finish his term.
He may well be anointing the next president of the United States. And the idea that in that process, he is anointing a woman and a woman of color makes this a very significant pick.
The pick both pleased the president.
She was my number one pick.
And surprised him.
She did very poorly in the primaries.
The president argues Harris is about the most liberal person in the Senate. St. Anselm College analyst Chris Galdieri says the GOP attack plan is clear. Harris is a radical and will push Biden left.
Be the secret power behind the throne and drag Biden over to the, you know, Bernie Sanders wing of the party.
Sagar Mirghani, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump commented about Biden's selection during an evening press conference Tuesday.
I've been watching her for a long time, and I was a little surprised. She was extraordinarily nasty to Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh then, now Justice Kavanaugh. She was nasty to a level that was just a horrible thing, the way she treated now Justice Kavanaugh. And I won't forget that soon. So she did very poorly in the primaries, and now she's chosen. So let's see how that all works.
International Edition's Lori London spoke to Jennifer Lawless for analysis on the choice of Kamala Harris and what it could mean for the campaign. She's a professor of politics at the University of Virginia.
I think it was the strongest pick and the safest pick. Kamala Harris has the background that will really propel the ticket, both in terms of her prosecutorial background, but also her Senate experience. And in terms of politics, she's demonstrated a willingness to fight really hard on the campaign trail. And that's going to get under Donald Trump's skin.
What does it say about the former vice president that he chose someone that probably went after him harder in the debates than anybody else? And it probably would have had many people thinking they'd be enemies after that.
Well, first, I think it demonstrates that when he said he doesn't hold grudges, he means he doesn't hold grudges. Second, I think he's willing to put the future of the country ahead of a spat on the debate stage. If he thinks that she's the best opportunity to move forward and to defeat Donald Trump, he's going to take it. And third, I think it really serves as a great juxtaposition with Donald Trump, because if anybody holds grudges, it's Trump. And so by virtue of picking Kamala Harris, Joe Biden has demonstrated how different he is in terms of personality and in terms of style than the current occupant of the White House.
What about Kamala herself? Besides her savvy prosecutorial skills, what do you think some of the other things that she brings to this ticket, and do they change anything as far as the campaign itself?
It's helpful that as a former prosecutor, she is able to talk about Black Lives Matter without making it synonymous with defunding the police. That puts the Democratic ticket in a much better position. It makes it difficult for Donald Trump to argue that this is a ticket that doesn't believe we should have police officers across the country when Kamala Harris's background suggests otherwise. I also think that it's really important to highlight that although she's only a freshman senator, during her time in the Senate, she's gained a working knowledge of Washington and the current senators. Biden's been out of the Senate for a long time, and so she's also able to navigate and be familiar with the current personalities who are going to be vital, especially the Democrats wind up taking back the Senate, we're going to be vital to ensuring that they have the votes they need to move legislation forward.
What about the fact that she is a Black woman, but also of Asian descent?
That, I think, is very, very important because it highlights that Joe Biden is aware of the fact that the Democratic Party is diverse. He's aware of the fact that the Democratic coalition depends strongly on people of color and women of color in particular. And when he said he's going to make sure that his administration looks like America, this is the first decision he's had to make, and it suggests that he's taking that seriously.
Do you think that this decision could actually increase turnout?
I think it can generate enthusiasm that might have been tepid. Donald Trump and the Trump administration seem to be motivating Democrats to turn out. So the fact that Joe Biden wasn't necessarily everybody's first choice or people weren't that enthusiastic about him didn't seem to be as much of a liability as we might expect, given Democrats and some independents' distaste for the president. But there's no question that she can help. It's also important to note, she's cool. On the campaign trail, she's cool. When she's doing media interviews, she's cool. And the same way that Barack Obama was able to communicate to people, she can get out there on the campaign trail and talk to people in a way that doesn't make her seem like a stuffy politician. That's going to also juxtapose this ticket, I think, from the Trump-Pence ticket.
And do you think that the things that you just said can overcome whatever disappointment some more progressives may have about the choice?
I think that Joe Biden has demonstrated, and if you look at the speaking list for the convention with Bernie Sanders, with Elizabeth Warren, with AOC, he's demonstrated that he's taking very, very seriously advice and counsel from the more progressive wing of the party. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're heavily represented in the cabinet and in the administration more broadly. But at the end of the day, this has to be somebody that he feels like he can work with and that he agrees with and that will complement him. And most people would agree, I think, that it's better to have a ticket where the two people like each other, get along, and are able to campaign together, especially in a very bizarre environment right now, than check off a series of boxes on policies where the big differences are not really between the moderates and the progressives on the Democratic side. They're between the Democrats and the Republicans.
What do you foresee coming at Biden and Harris from the Trump campaign going forward?
I think one line of argument will be that it's about identity politics and that the Democratic Party only cares about making sure that they're talking to people of color or women, and it'll sort of play into the message that the Trump campaign established in 2016, which was basically, if you're a white guy, you should be very afraid. The country is moving away from you. And so I think a pick like Kamala Harris allows them to continue along with that argument. I don't think it'll be that effective this time around. First of all, it may have been effective because people didn't like Hillary Clinton. It may not have been that it was effective in and of itself. Second, it may have been effective then, except right now we're amid a pandemic and we're amid a terrible economy. So those circumstances have changed. The other type of attack that I can foresee is going to be a tough one for the Trump campaign because it's somewhat hypocritical, but they're going to suggest that she, as a prosecutor and as attorney general, made some bad decisions. The problem for them is that the decisions that they're going to be condemning are decisions that they probably would have made and that are certainly no worse than anybody in the Trump Justice Department.
That was University of Virginia Professor of Politics Jennifer Lawless, and she was speaking to International Edition's Lori London. The novel coronavirus pandemic continues to have an effect on the sporting world as two major U.S. college athletic conferences announced on Tuesday they are postponing their fall American football seasons. In addition to American football, the Big Ten Conference says it is postponing all of its fall sporting activities, including men's and women's track and field, as well as soccer. The Pac-12 group of universities says it would not hold any sporting competitions for the remainder of 2020. It's uncertain what effect the sports cancellations will have on the universities, as they are a major source of revenue for many. Globally, there are over 20.3 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to statistics collected by Johns Hopkins University. New Zealand is again under lockdown restrictions after four COVID-19 infections were detected in Auckland, the South Pacific country's biggest city. Phil Mercer reports they are the first confirmed cases of community transmission of the coronavirus in more than 100 days.
In June, New Zealand declared a victory in its fight against COVID-19. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the country had united in unprecedented ways to crush the virus. Restrictions were lifted and life began to return to what it was before the pandemic, although New Zealand's international borders stayed closed. But the coronavirus had not gone away. After more than 3 months without a local infection, 4 cases have been found among a family in Auckland. None had recently travelled overseas, and the source of the disease is being urgently investigated. Auckland, a city of 1.6 million people, is now subject to Stage 3 restrictions. Bars and restaurants have closed, along with schools. Workers have been told to stay at home, although staff in essential services are exempt. The lockdown will last for at least 3 days. Less stringent measures, including limits on gatherings and social distancing protocols, apply to the rest of New Zealand. The Health Minister, Chris Hipkins, told New Zealand Radio that the government wanted to avoid a surge in cases seen overseas, including in the Australian city of Melbourne.
We're taking a very, very precautionary approach here. One of the reasons that we're moving very swiftly and that we're moving to level 3 for Auckland very quickly is we want to do everything we can to avoid a situation like Melbourne. You know, one of the lessons from overseas is you can't be too hard too soon. The faster you move, the better your chances.
Ahead of Wednesday's lockdown, large crowds of shoppers were seen queuing at supermarkets, despite officials insisting that panic buying wasn't necessary. The World Health Organization had highlighted New Zealand as an example to other nations for having successfully eliminated community transmission. The re-emergence of the virus shows how difficult it is to stamp it out. Australia too has seen a resurgence of COVID-19 in some states, including New South Wales and Victoria, where a strict lockdown has been imposed. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
The World Health Organization is releasing guidance on measures to be taken by dental health professionals and patients on oral health services to minimize the risk of being infected with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein has that story.
As everyone in the world can attest, having a toothache is no fun, and when the pain is bad enough, people will go to the dentist. However, a World Health Organization survey of 103 countries between May and mid-July finds COVID-19 has affected dental services around the world in unprecedented ways. Dental officer in WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, Benoit Varenne, says 75% of survey respondents reported dental services have been completely or partially disrupted because of the coronavirus. He says the high level of disruption is linked to the nature of the work provided by the oral healthcare personnel.
As you know, dentists, dental nurses, hygienists, and dental assistants work in close contact with patients and are exposed to saliva and blood. And also they are using what we call spray generating equipment. And all this equipment are generating what we call airborne particles or aerosol.
In communities where transmission of the coronavirus is high, Varenne says WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases. And in the treatment of patients, he says dental workers should avoid or minimize procedures that may generate aerosols, which can spread the infection, and prioritize the use of hand instruments.
And, of course, to delay routine, non-essential oral health care. This means oral health checkup, dental cleaning, preventive care, and certainly also some aesthetic dental treatment.
Other WHO recommendations include remote screening, maintaining physical distancing, and wearing masks before and in between dental sessions to prevent and reduce the risk of transmission. Varenne says one of the most pressing issues is to ensure all dental workers have personal protective equipment. This is essential, he says, to protect themselves from becoming infected with COVID-19 and passing it on to their patients. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And still to come,
Android phones on Tuesday began detecting earthquakes around the world to provide data that could eventually give billions of users precious seconds of warning.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. NASA's Dawn spacecraft spent about 3.5 years orbiting and exploring the dwarf planet Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt. A series of recently published papers based on analysis of data gathered in the final year of Dawn's mission provides new evidence regarding the dwarf planet's geological activity as well as the source of its mysterious bright spots. Scientists previously found the bright spots are actually salt deposits that were left after briny water had evaporated. The new paper suggests that the briny water bubbled to the surface from an underground reservoir about 40 kilometers deep and hundreds of kilometers wide. The new research also confirms that the bright regions are young, with some of the deposits being less than 2 million years old, and that the geologic activity that creates them could be ongoing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo welcomed the recent agreement between the Republic of Yemen government and the Southern Transitional Council to advance the terms of the Riyadh Agreement, which will pave the way for a unified government that can counter the Houthi aggression. Stephen Sesh is the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. He discussed the chances of reaching a settlement in Yemen with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Mohammed, I do believe that reviving the Riyadh Agreement and moving toward full implementation will be an important step in healing the deep fissures in the Saudi-led coalition and preventing the widespread violence and greater instability in the South that we've seen undermining efforts to create a national solution. So all of this, if in fact there is implementation, if the parties can agree to work together, this will definitely support the efforts of the UN Special Envoy to bring the parties to the conflict to the negotiations table, and that is definitely a positive step forward.
Pompeo said the conflict in Yemen has raged in large part because of the Islamic Republic of Iran's illegal arms transfer to the Houthis. To what extent Iran did intensify the conflict in Yemen?
I think that there's no doubt that Iran shares blame in the fact that the war has continued as long as it has, because it has transferred components for ballistic missiles, aerial drones, and landmines, as well as small arms in large quantities to the Houthis. So this has contributed to the ability of the Houthi rebels to maintain a dominant position in many areas of the battlefield in Yemen. That said, I'm still not convinced that this support from Iran has been decisive. Even without it, it's my contention that Saudi Arabia could never have reasonably expected to defeat an entrenched, battle-hardened insurgency by conducting an air war, which has been its principal instrument of warfare since they entered the war in March of 2015.
The UN envoy tried several times to secure a ceasefire and pave the way for a negotiated settlement. Why all these efforts never succeeded?
You know, Mohammed, I'm afraid there are elements on both sides of the war. That is to say, within the Hadi government and in the Houthi political leadership, who are convinced that a military victory is not just needed, but is also an option on the table. Therefore, they resist agreeing to the compromises that are essential to reach a negotiated settlement to the war. I'm not convinced there is any military victory within reach of these parties. The war has been at a stalemate now for well over a year, longer than that perhaps. So it is time to get away from that line of thinking and move towards a negotiations table.
So what's needed, practically speaking, to end the long conflict in Yemen?
I think two things come to mind. In the first instance, the external players who are present in Yemen advancing their own political agendas need to step away and let Yemenis resolve this conflict themselves. And second, Yemen's political elite need to demonstrate the maturity and the leadership to really lean into negotiations, find common ground, and bring this long nightmare to an end.
Stephen Sesh was the U.S. ambassador to Yemen under both the Bush and Obama administrations, who was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. Government documents seen by Reuters News shows that Lebanon's prime minister and president were reportedly warned of a possible major disaster in Beirut as recently as July, just 2 weeks before the blast that devastated the city. Customs and security officials made pleas to judges seeking permission to remove the tons of explosive materials stored at the port roughly every 6 months for years. The blast resulted in at least 163 people being killed, over 6,000 wounded, and much of the capital has been left in ruins. The Prime Minister's office and the presidency did not respond to requests for comment about the letter, although President Michel Aoun confirmed last week that he had been informed about the material. Google has begun using its phones to help save lives, and Reuters' Lisa Bernard explains how.
It works through what are called accelerometers, tiny built-in sensors that measure direction and force of motion that are mainly used to determine whether a phone is in landscape or portrait mode. But they can also sense earthquakes when the phone is plugged in and stationary. Alerts would trigger for earthquakes magnitude 4.5 or greater and give some users up to a minute of notice. Mark Stogaitis is principal software engineer at Google.
Now, as an earthquake starts to propagate, the phones that are closest to the epicenter, they feel shaking and send a signal to the Google Earthquake Detection Server along with a coarse location of where shaking is happening. We then aggregate data from many phones to determine if an earthquake is happening and how big it is.
People expected to experience strong shaking would hear a loud dinging and see a full-screen warning to drop, cover, and hold on. Those further away would get a smaller notification designed not to stir them from their sleep. Google, which itself is located near California's San Andreas Fault, expects to issue its first alerts next year, beginning in California.
That was Reuters reporter Lisa Bernard. Singer and actor Trini Lopez has died from complications of COVID-19 in Palm Springs, California. He was 83. Reuters music correspondent Margie Zerolata has a look at his career.
Lemon tree, very pretty.
Trinidad Lopez III was told to change his name to help his career. He said no, because he embraced his Mexican-American heritage. His first gigs as a guitarist were playing in Dallas nightclubs that did not allow Mexican-Americans. He was famous for his versions of the songs Lemon Tree and If I Had a Hammer. He crossed over into acting, appearing in the Dirty Dozen movie and TV's Adam 12. Rock musicians The Edge and Dave Grohl were among the fans of the guitars that Lopez designed. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early June, the U.S. Agency for International Development committed more than $350 million to help countries across sub-Saharan Africa respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. The funds will ensure that we continue our life-saving mission and work, as well as support our partner countries in their own COVID-19 response, said Acting Assistant Administrator for Africa, Chris Baloney. But there is more at stake here. What's keeping me up at night more than anything else are the second and third effects of what COVID is doing, said Assistant Administrator Maloney.
And what I mean by that are the economic issues, right? So we're spending a lot of time right now thinking about things like food security. And for USAID, it's, you know, traditionally we work on the rural sector, but increasingly this is an urban issue. So when you have a lot of people under lockdown, how do we think through things like cash transfers, ensuring that supply chains from rural markets get to urban markets? This has been a very key issue for us.
One of the problems we're actually seeing right now across Africa is dealing with the effects of countries that have low commitments, things that help or hinder a country, and using COVID as a way to increase their authoritarianism around the continent, said Acting Assistant Administrator Maloney.
So, for example, there's been over 20,000 Zimbabweans who have been locked up for violating the lockdown rules there, and there's been a lot of allegations of human rights concerns. So we want to make sure that we're thinking about how can we play a part in working with civil society to advocate when there are challenges like this.
At the same time, said Acting Assistant Administrator Maloney, there's just a lot of misinformation that's being proffered around.
So we actually just spent a grant in several countries in the Sahel and other parts of West Africa to work with radio stations and civil society groups to counter disinformation and ensure that the right messaging is getting out on how to deal with the crisis.
I'm confident, said Acting Assistant Administrator Maloney, that our relationships and the shared experiences that we've had with our African country partners over the past decades will continue to help us meet both today's COVID-19 crisis and the broader development issues at hand head on.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.